So NFTs, where to start with the legal issues?
Welcome to Warfare of Art and Law, the podcast that focuses on how justice does or doesn't play out when art and law overlap. Hi, everyone. It's Stephanie. And that was Institute of Art and Law Assistant Director Emily Gould from a recent Second Saturday Art and Justice online gathering giving an update on NFTs. In the following, Emily describes the meteoric rise of NFTs, the risks and benefits associated with them, and describes the many fascinating projects that have arisen using these unique tokens. Emily Gould, thank you so much for being here to give an NFT update, and whenever you're ready.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Stephanie, and it would be a pleasure, no doubt. So, and these three little letters, NFT, have certainly played a much bigger role in my life than I could ever have imagined just about 2.5 years ago. My interest really was sparked, along with many, many other people's, with the rather explosive entry onto the art market of NFTs through the Beeple sales, the sale of a work by digital artist Beeple for the sum of $69 million. That certainly got people talking back in March 2021. And there were many people at the time who were rather skeptical about this new technology and thought this might all be a flash in the pan and wouldn't be something we would still be talking about even as little as 2.5 years later. But we certainly are. And much has happened since that date. And I'm sure, as all of you who follow the art world news or the tech news or indeed the mainstream press really are well aware, the prices of NFTs and the value of NFTs have gone up and down. There's been a bit of a roller coaster ride since that entry onto the market in March 2021. And in general, the trajectory has been somewhat downwards, because NFTs are so very closely connected with cryptocurrencies. So as the value of many cryptocurrencies has dived, NFTs have somewhat followed. So all that's to say, as a sort of proportion of the art market in general, they occupy a fairly small space, really. So I don't know if any of you follow the UBS Art Basel Art Market reports, the kind of financial reports that come out every year. The one for this year estimated that the total value of the global art market is something like, I think it was $67.8 billion. Now, the ways of sort of calculating these statistics obviously vary, and there are different parameters, but they then looked at the sales of NFTs through the major NFT platforms and calculated that art-related NFTs specifically amounted to something like $1.5 billion. So obviously compared with the art market more generally, that is a very small percentage. If you include what we might call collectibles NFTs, and I'll come on to describe what these different things are, then the proportion goes up quite considerably. So collectibles NFTs, the market for those was estimated to be something like $11.8 billion. So if you add those together, then you're coming to something like the NFT art and collectibles market being something around 15% or so, maybe a little more, of the global art market. But the amount of press coverage art NFTs have got over the last 2.5 years seems maybe somewhat disproportionate with those figures. And I think it's something, I mean, I got interested in all of this because of the huge interest from the art market. And the fact that, you know, these stories just kept on coming. So I wrote my first blog about NFTs shortly after that Beeple sale. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll engage in this space a little bit more over the next year or so. Not really anticipating that literally every week that went by, there was another story, another legal issue that arose. So it's been endlessly fascinating. And kind of, I suppose for me, culminated just in the last couple of months in me giving evidence to a parliamentary select committee in the UK that is looking into whether there needs to be more regulation in this space, what the risks are, as well as what the benefits are, and really what the UK government should be doing to create the most sort of friendly environment for NFTs going forwards. So that kind of brought us up to date with where I am on all of this at the moment. So what I thought I would do was just to say, I think before we start, that legal issues arise at pretty much every stage of what we might call the NFT life cycle. So from the creation of a work, let's say by a digital artist, and that's where I'm going to focus mainly in the next half hour or so, NFTs as vehicles for selling digital art. So you create your work, you then mint your work as an NFT, you put it up for sale, most commonly on an NFT platform, it then is sold to a buyer, and then it's traded through a secondary market. At every stage there are a whole plethora of legal issues which arise from many different legal disciplines, as we'll see. I thought I'd start with a few key definitions. Now, some of you may know these already, so I'm not going to dwell on them, but just so that we all sort of start from the same page, the NFTs themselves, those non-fungible tokens. I like to describe this simply because I should say that I most definitely come at this from a legal angle, not a tech angle. So I like to really sort of simplify these technology definitions as much as I can. So NFTs then, I like to kind of look at the two key components there, the non-fungibility and the token. What is that token? And it is essentially a line of computer code. That's what an NFT is. That's what the token is. And that line of code generally links to or points to another asset, an underlying asset. And that might be a work of digital art. And that's the kind of archetypal NFT, I would say. That's what we probably most of us think of when we think about NFTs. But it could be any number of assets, and you know the potential categories or types of work which could constitute that underlying asset are pretty limitless, really. So it could point to a physical work of art. It could point to, let's say, a ticket for an event. It could link to real estate potentially. So as I say, many different kinds of assets, to a video game or a component of a video game. Lots of possibilities there for what that underlying asset, which the NFT really is a vehicle to trade in, essentially, what that asset might be. So that's the token then. Non-fungibility. Now, it's a bit of a fancy term, but all it really means is uniqueness, the quality of uniqueness. If something is non-fungible, it's not transferable one for another. So this quality of uniqueness is what distinguishes an NFT from a unit of cryptocurrency. And I make that distinction, I make that comparison, because NFTs essentially grew out of and became kind of another layer on cryptocurrency and the technology which supports cryptocurrencies. So if I give you 10 Bitcoin, let's say, one of the commonest forms of cryptocurrency, if I give you 10 Bitcoin, I'm very happy for you to give me 10 Bitcoins in exchange because they mean the same thing. Their value is identical. However, if let's compare it to, say, works of art. If I offer you an exchange of the little doodle that I made whilst waiting to come on this call. If I offer you that in exchange for your Rembrandt, you're probably not very happy to make that exchange because those two things are unique and they have a different value. So that's really all that non-fungibility is. And it's that unique quality that has made NFTs a very attractive prospect for digital artists, and we'll come on to look at why that is. So that's our NFT then, setting the basics. NFTs depend upon blockchain technology. Again, I'm going to really simplify this. And in the simplest of terms, a blockchain is essentially a very large and very sophisticated kind of database. So like think a very, very fancy Excel spreadsheet. And what it is able to do is to record in real time, in immutable form, every transaction in relation to an asset which is recorded on that blockchain. Most blockchains operate in accordance with something called distributed ledger technology, DLT. And what this means is that those blockchains and their data and their structure is distributed across a whole massive network of computers. There is no central control. And this is very important, and it kind of provides the whole ethos of blockchain and NFT technology. This notion that blockchain is effectively owned by and controlled by a whole enormous network, a whole community, not one centralized form of control. And so these blockchains operate through consensus mechanisms. So in order to add another block to that chain, so in order to sort of validate a new transaction, essentially everyone in that network has to agree to add that new block, that new transaction to the network, to the chain. So there we have this consensus mechanism. And there are various protocols which determine how these blockchains work. The blockchain on which NFTs are generally bought and sold is called Ethereum. And the protocol, well, one of the main protocols is called ERC 71. So that's just the name for the way in which the blockchain operates. NFTs are bought and sold on these blockchains via smart contracts. And so we're not thinking legal contract here. Smart contracts, again, are lines of code. They're little computer programs which basically perform particular actions in response to triggers. So a very simple example would be that if I buy an NFT, I pay my purchase price, and the receipt on the network of that purchase price, usually in cryptocurrency, will trigger a transfer of ownership of that NFT from the seller to me, the buyer. So the trigger is receipt of the purchase price, and then the action is transfer of that ownership. Smart contracts, very interesting. They obviously have a lot of utility within this NFT space. There are lots of ongoing debates about whether or not they could constitute a legal contract, whether they have those essential elements of the contract, our offer, acceptance, consideration. And I think most scholars, I think there is a developing consensus that there's no inherent reason why they cannot operate as a legally binding contract. But as I say, it's kind of an ongoing debate, and there aren't any decided cases that I know of looking at that specific point. Now on to kind of a slightly wider but connected areas. And as I say, I come at this not from a sort of a techie perspective. So again, very sort of really distilling what I understand to be these concepts down to sort of some of the basics. Web3 is essentially a sort of blockchain-based web technology. So I read a very sort of basic explanation of how we have come from the beginning of the web to Web3. And so this is how I'm going to explain it, because it made sense to me. Web1 was effectively read-only. So when the web first emerged, me, you, anybody could go on there and effectively read information that someone else fed out to us. That was web one. Web two was read-write, in that there was an element of interactivity. I could interact, I could post things myself. Moving on again, web three has been described as read-write-own. So because of that blockchain structure, we can all own a bit of that network, own data on that network. There isn't a central controller, central owner. So Web3 and this kind of blockchain-based technology, they are kind of part of the same thing, the same deal. The metaverse, again, I think people would probably agree that at the moment we haven't reached the stage where there is one big single metaverse that we can all engage in, that there are a number of kind of embryonic developing metaverses, we might say. But I think the general concept of the metaverse is that it is a space, it's a kind of online virtual replica of our offline real lives. That's how I think of it anyway. So we can operate in an online environment, often through avatars and often using virtual reality or augmented reality technology. We can live a second life, if you like. Second Life, that was the game, wasn't it, years ago? But things have developed and are still developing very rapidly in that space. I was at the other day, actually, at a conference about the metaverse more generally, and we had this amazing demonstration of the way in which you can use holograms, basically to kind of almost teleport people in the virtual world. So we were talking about how this might be really useful for courtrooms going forward. So can you have a completely online courtroom where people attend by hologram? And you can see, so it's kind of one step on from what we're doing now, you know, Zoom and just sort of more kind of 2D interaction, because you can see, you know, you can see a person in 3D, you can see them in you can see the body language. So there's a lot of discussion about how this could be really interesting, as I say, for courts going forward. So who are the stakeholders from an art market perspective in this new NFT world? Well, the whole shebang, really. You know, lots of different interests are kind of getting engaged. Obviously, artists and content creators, most particularly digital artists, the consumers and the collectors, museums and galleries are getting engaged in this space in some, what I think are very interesting ways. And hopefully I'll leave myself enough time to just give you a few examples there. The NFT marketplaces and platforms, it's interesting. So when this movement started, there was, as I already mentioned, this real ethos of kind of community. It was this new community. It was a democratization of the art world. Everybody could get involved. There weren't any barriers. Increasingly, as so often happens in life in general, power and the money is kind of, it's that pyramid structure is kind of congregating in a number of players, and the platforms certainly are playing quite a powerful role in this whole sphere. But traditional art market players are also involved. So the auction houses, Christie's, Sotheby's, Phillips, all of the big auction houses have got involved, you know, in quite a big way. There have been some really amazing NFT sales. And, you know, they're still there. They're still around. I just noticed that Sotheby's had quite a big sale of, I think it was a cryptocurrency company or a crypto company that had gone insolvent. So there was a sort of a fire sale, I should say, of lots of NFTs that they had owned, and that all seemed to go quite well. So moving on then. So what are the current use cases for the visual arts sector? I've mentioned digital artists several times, so I'm just going to look at that a little bit more now. So I remember a panel that I spoke on quite shortly after the Beeple sale, so in the sort of spring of 2021, And there were a couple of people involved from the tech side. There was somebody from an auction house, and there was a digital artist. And she described how she had got into NFT trading. And she described the moment when she first really understood what it all meant and what it could do for her. She described that as a light bulb moment. And so she got into NFTs kind of very early on, really, in 2017. And she's now been successfully trading her digital art through NFTs ever since. And what she described and what is often highlighted as the really sort of important aspect for digital artists is that before NFTs, she found it very hard to sort of build up her market. Yes, she got commissions here and there. And she created what she called screen-based media. So videos, various graphic, online graphic works. And the problem with digital art is that as soon as you put it out there, it's so very easy to copy. And we all know about copyright, and we'll have a little look at that in a minute. But in reality, it's very, very hard to control the copying and the reproduction of your work once it is out there on the internet for everyone to see. But what an NFT does is to give you that quality of uniqueness. So remember, that token is non-fungible. There is only one token. And so by imbuing digital art, if you like, with that quality of uniqueness, it has given digital artists a route to market and a way of making their work, or giving that work that quality of uniqueness. So there are also other advantages, more kind of clearly tangible advantages for digital artists. So for the first time, really, it has given digital artists a direct selling platform. They can connect directly with their customers and their collectors. So the art market is, of course, very well known for being controlled, you might say, in some ways, by middlemen. So by agents and dealers, who often end up kind of getting the biggest cuts of sales proceeds. And, you know, it can be difficult for artists then to build up that direct relationship themselves with their collectors, their customers. But NFTs allow a digital artist to do that. And certainly, you know, there are these communities of interest that have built up. And then I suppose most clearly tangibly, there is this huge advantage for digital artists that they can build in to the smart contracts through which they sell their work an automatic resale royalty, such that every time their work then is sold on after the first sale on the platform on which they've minted it, that is one bit of a caveat, but on that platform, they will then automatically get a kickback. They'll get a certain percentage, whatever they set that percentage at. And some of the big marketplaces now, as a kind of a standard term, do build in that resale royalty. Now, there is, some of you may know that there is, in the traditional art market, there is something called an artist resale right. But it operates in a different way. It's not a contractual right. It's statutory. It's not global. It doesn't operate in all countries. You don't have it in the US, for example. So a lot of the big art markets don't have it. And it's not altogether clear in many jurisdictions that it would apply to digital works in any event. It's mainly focused on physical works. So the resale royalty that you can get as a digital artist through NFTs can be very, very useful. There are some wrinkles around it. I alluded to one earlier on. If you take an NFT off chain, so it's called, if you take it off the chain on which it's originally minted, so one of the biggest marketplaces is a platform called OpenSea. Take it off there and you try to resell it on, say, a Nifty gateway, then that's going to probably break the operability of the smart contract. So you won't necessarily, as the artist who's minted it and offered it for sale initially on OpenSea, you won't necessarily get your royalty back. So that is a bit of a wrinkle, but there may be a way of people with very clever technological brains of solving that going forwards. But at the moment, it is a known kind of, as I say, bit of caveat to the advantages of the resale royalty. So the kinds of digital art we see being bought and sold through NFTs is really, really variable. So we have the one-off works, the likes of the Beeple 5,000 day, every day is 5,000, the first 5,000 days. And then aside of those, there are day in, day out, there are works being sold by much lesser known digital artists on these platforms, you know, for much lower values. And then there are what we've called collectibles. And these are works which are bought because of their collectible qualities, usually rather than their kind of aesthetic qualities, we might say. So I'm sure you've probably all heard of the Bored Ape Yacht Club NFTs, the CryptoPunks, and they're very, very simple. The CryptoPunks started out as these 8-bit kind of algorithmically generated works. The second use case for NFTs within the art world is a bit of a different one, and it is to authenticate physical artworks. The idea here is that you create a link between a physical work of art and a record on the blockchain, so a digital record. So that serves a number of functions. It can give you it can act as a certificate of ownership. And then when you go on to deal in your physical work art, say you sell it, but you might also do other things with it. You might lend it. You might provide it as collateral against a loan. You might provide it as security. All of those things can then be recorded on the blockchain, on this immutable, kind of incorruptible record on a blockchain. So there are a number of companies set up to provide this kind of a service. So this in the US, this is a company called Flipkick. It's been around for some time, actually. And then in the UK, there is a company called ArtClear. It's indelibly linking the digital records to the physical artworks. They have a very, very sophisticated scanning technique to make that initial record. And then, as I say, you can record your transactions going forward. Now, linked to the way in which these companies operate is this concept that people have talked a lot about, that the blockchain can provide security of provenance for works of art. So provenance has been a perennial challenge for the traditional art market. And by provenance, we mean, of course, the ability to trace the chain of transactions from the current owner or possessor of work right back, ideally, the gold standard, right back to the artist. That's as I say, that would be the gold standard. Often that's not possible. But as I say, it's very challenging in the traditional art market. And people have said, well, look, with blockchain, we get those records on there. They're completely transparent. Anyone can see them. They're immutable. They're going to be there forever. Surely that is, you know, that cures all of those provenance challenges. Now, certainly there are advantages, but I would say that we need to sort of think about this with a slightly cautious mind for a number of reasons, but I think two particular reasons are that, firstly, that old adage, what do they call it? GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. I mean, those records on the blockchain are only as good as the data which is put in there in the first place. And so, you know, if there is a misattribution or if there's been a copyright infringement, the fact that that data is then replicated across this whole network of computers and it's there to stay, it doesn't cure that initial legal problem. So that's one reason why I think we need to be just, you know, just a cautious, as I say, in how we think about what a blockchain might do for provenance. And the second reason is because the transparency of a blockchain. So if you look at NFT transactions, if you look on one of the marketplaces, yes, you can. A transaction is transparent, but basically all you can see is the movement of a work from one digital wallet to another digital wallet, and it's all in code. So it doesn't mean much to me. I can't write computer code. And I can't see by looking at the transaction who sits behind those digital wallets. Now, there may be a way for me to get that information, say, you know, if I've been the victim of a theft or something from my digital wallet, but that might take me going to court, you know, and so that's not an option that is open to most people. It's not a step you're going to take lightly every day. So again, the transparency element, yes, there is transparency, but it only goes so far. So the third use case then for NFTs in the art world is this notion of fractionalized ownership. So the idea here is that I will never be able to afford a Picasso or a Rembrandt or a Miro or any other artist you can think of. But maybe I can afford to be a 0.0001% share owner in one of those amazing works. And maybe I can purchase an NFT which represents that tiny, tiny percentage of that greater work. So there are companies set up to operate this kind of a service. That might be one way of doing it. But another way might be for me to get together a whole big group of like-minded people and for us to create our own organization based around blockchain. And these organizations are generally called DAOs, decentralized autonomous organizations. And this conference that I was at the other day, there was a guy there who is on the sort of council, on the kind of governing board, you might call it, of one of the first DAOs to be set up to deal in NFT art. And really fascinating how these organizations work. And I think it's going to be an interesting area going forwards, because we were discussing in this conference the kinds of legal issues which might arise, because DAOs are, they don't really have any direct analogy in terms of their legal status and what kind of an entity they are. So one of the lawyers I was talking to was saying she was absolutely dreading her first case that involved a DAO, because it's going to be so difficult to work out where liabilities might lie. Fractional.art. So that is a company where you can go and buy a fraction of a work through an NFT. And DAO that I was just talking about, where I met the guy involved the other day. So it's called ArtSect. Really interesting. And it's very much a collective. And so you can, as an artist, a digital or physical artist, you can get involved. And what I also found very interesting was that they do actually have a physical space. And I think this is something we're going to kind of see more of going forward, the interaction between the digital and the physical, because I think I think it's probably no coincidence that NFTs became a massive thing during lockdown times. Okay, people were in their own space. It was just them and their computer screens. They wanted to interact. They wanted to find ways of expressing their creativity, of maybe, you know, spending a bit of money, enjoying the nice things in life, which, you know, you just couldn't do in the real world. But now I think as IRL life is coming back, I think people want that physical personal interaction more as well. And so I think we're going to see more, as I say, of this kind of physical embodiment or physical kind of interaction, with the digital world. And so I really like this word digital marketplace. So the combination of the physical and the digital. So as I say, they do have this creative physical space in Hackney in London, where you can go and look at the NFT art physically presented to you. So goodness me, I've talked for far too long about nothing remotely legal, but I hope that's been a bit of interesting background. I am now going to literally just move through some of the legal issues which arise one by one in kind of oral bullet point fashion. So copyright infringement, massive issue, and copyright issues arise at every stage of the NFT life cycle. So I'm going to boil it down to two key questions. Can I mint a work as an NFT in the first place? I can pretty much only do that if I own the copyright in that work, or if I have a license which enables me to reproduce the work and to sell it and distribute it. So if I create a new digital artwork on my own, likely it is, I might be okay. But as we all know, the creation of works of art is often a much, much more complex process. It involves lots of different people who might have different inputs. You know, we only have to think about appropriation art. And, you know, so the answer to that question is often not that simple. So that's the first issue. Can I even mint a work? Can I create an NFT means of trading that work? Then if we look at things from the other point of view, the buyer's point of view, when I buy an NFT, let's say, of a digital work of art, what am I getting? And I think particularly in the early stages of the NFT boom, if we can call it that, there was a lot of confusion around this issue, and people felt, perhaps not unreasonably, you might think, if they were paying, hundreds of thousands of dollars for something, they were getting everything. They were getting all possible rights relating to that work. But of course, essentially what you get when you buy an NFT is almost always not the copyright to the underlying work, but a license. And that might be a very limited license. It might enable you to do nothing more than to display that work on your screen, to maybe display it in another NFT marketplace or NFT space, which protects that work cryptographically. It might also be that you get a wider license that allows you to commercialize it. The Bored Ape Yacht Club licenses are well known for being quite open. They do allow you some commercialization rights, but that is relatively unusual, I would say, as a model. So you only have those license rights, and you certainly can't do anything you like with the underlying work in almost all situations. So a few little examples then. The burnt Banksy examples are very early on, fairly soon after the Beeple sale, I think it was. This group of young guys together, they had purchased a Banksy print, and then they took it upon themselves to set a light to that print and to video themselves doing so. And the sort of philosophical idea behind this stunt was to, as they described it, to transfer the value of that Banksy work, all of the value, into an NFT. And of course, they either sort of flagrantly disregarded any copyright or just didn't sort of understand some of the fundamentals of copyright law, in that by videoing this torching of the Banksy work, they were most likely infringing Banksy's copyright, potential moral rights issues. Whether or not Banksy would ever pursue any of those, of course, is a different matter. But there were probably some fundamental copyright issues at stake there. Another incident emerged where a company put up for sale on the platform OpenSea an NFT of a Basquiat print. And they actually said the word something like, together with all intellectual property and copyrights, and the Basquiat estate very quickly objected to that offer because the company selling the NFT had absolutely no copyright. The copyright in the Basquiat print was owned by the Basquiat estate. There have been some other fairly major examples too of just fundamental misunderstandings, really, of copyright law. Trademark infringement, really interesting cases there. Some of you might have followed this Hermes and Rothschild case. So Hermes have this very famous, iconic bag called the Birkin bag. They have a trademark for that physical object. This guy, Mason Rothschild, decided to create a digital Meta Birkin, he called it, which he sold as an NFT without any permission from Hermes. And they've recently won in their trademark infringement case against Rothschild. His argument was essentially a First Amendment argument in his defense. He said, well, this is just an artistic project, you know, just expressing my own artistic creativity. But court didn't accept that that defense. Commercial risks. Most NFTs are bought and sold, as I mentioned, on these big marketplaces. I've listed a few of them there, OpenSea, NFT Gateway. There are quite a few now. When you trade on those platforms, you are signing up to the standard terms and conditions of those platforms. Most of them are US-based, so they will be subject to US law, or the law of a specific US state. There are lots of issues around the roles of those platforms and whether or not they should actually have more responsibility for the content on those sites. If you look at most of their terms and conditions, they will say, we are just an interface. The transactions take place between users, so buyers and sellers. So we kind of have no responsibility for anything that might be that might end up on other platforms. That particularly artists and creators would very much like those platforms to have more responsibility for removing infringing content. You know, artists don't want to have to keep checking on those sites to see whether someone has, illicitly minted one of their works as an NFT. They want the platforms to bear some responsibility. There are, in some jurisdictions, there are moves to kind of make those platforms more responsible. There's a copyright directive, quite a new copyright directive in the EU, which may go some way towards making platforms more responsible. There are debates about the extent to which it might apply, but anyway, there are arguments and debates around that and what responsibilities platforms should have. There are some really interesting examples of confusion around what exactly you're signing up to when you try to buy an NFT. This Soleimani case, if you're interested in this area, I'd urge you to have a look at it. It's fascinating. So this guy basically wanted to buy a particular work, which was being traded sort of through an online auction. And so he made a bid for that work. And then it transpired that his bid was the third highest. So he didn't win. He didn't, make the highest bid. His was third. And then Nifty Gateway, the platform which was conducting this auction, said, okay, you need to cough up your 650,000, his third highest bid, for a third edition of this work. And he then said, well, hang on. I thought the deal was I got the original, the first edition, the original of that work, if I made the highest bid. I had no idea. You hadn't made clear to me the terms that said that I actually had to pay for a, third edition. I think it went down to like the first 100 or 99 had to have the limited edition, had to pay up what they bid. And so this has been through the courts. It's now at the stage where the point at issue is whether an arbitration clause in Nifty Gateway standard terms and conditions, which subject this UK consumer, or try to subject him, to arbitration in New York, whether that is enforceable against this guy as a UK consumer, or whether he is effectively protected by consumer law, the Consumer Rights Act in the UK, which would say that that kind of a clause is unenforceable against a consumer because it's not fair. So that, as I say, that is going through the UK courts at the moment. Okay, other areas of risk illicit activity. There was a stage where I think there was barely a week that went by where you didn't hear about the theft of someone's NFTs or fraudulent activity, somebody minting NFTs to which they didn't have any rights. There's been an interesting, what we might call a kind of market offence recently, an insider dealing case against an employee of OpenSea, the big platform OpenSea. And so he had basically sort of headlined certain specific NFTs before they went on sale to drive up prices, and then he would purchase them himself. So basically make a profit. He made something like, it was $57,000 out of this scheme, and he's been convicted by the US courts. The Osborne and the Tulip cases, those two cases are really fascinating. They're going through the UK courts at the moment about essentially thefts and hacks of NFTs. Been lots of discussion, partly coming out of one of those cases, about the property status of an NFT. And those are important discussions, because if an NFT is seen as, is regarded legally as a form of property, a lot of legal principles will flow from that. We're thinking about theft, for example. Theft is all about appropriating someone else's property. So huge debates about that. And the Law Commission in England and Wales has been looking at that point. Money laundering risks, I won't go into those, but there are certain risks around money laundering, and there is a certain lack of clarity about what the responsibilities of some of the stakeholders, some of the players in these markets are, particularly whether the platforms should have responsibility for having to conduct anti-money laundering checks. That's kind of a bit of a moot point at the moment. It's under discussion. Financial risks. It's very, very clear, it's abundantly clear that the value of NFTs can go up and down, and does indeed go up and down all the time. And so there is discussion about whether there should be protection of customers against those risks. And the headline point at the moment is that the focus in terms of financial risks within the crypto world more broadly has been on cryptocurrencies, because they are thought to involve a much greater risk than NFTs specifically. So NFTs have been kind of a bit out in the cold in this debate, but I think there is more and more focus on them. At the moment, they will only really be considered for and come within that financial control if they operate like a security. We haven't got time to go into that, but there are some instances which they might do so they might fall under the control of the financial conduct authorities. Data protection, another massive area. So there is so much data flying around in the NFT market and in the metaverse more broadly. And I think the kind of the answers in relation to the data protection questions are very much at the early stages of formation. Tax and estates planning, you know, if you die and you don't have any kind of records of your NFTs, what happens about, you know, can people inherit your NFTs? Lots of practical issues there. There have been massive environmental concerns from the beginning of the NFT boom, because the transactions on blockchain to buy and sell NFTs gobble up huge amounts of computational power, so not good for the environment, massive carbon footprint. And those involved in the technology behind NFTs and blockchain have been very aware of that and are trying to move towards systems which will use a lot less power. So it will be slightly more environmentally friendly. So just to conclude then, are NFTs, is this whole area a flash in the pan, or does it have a degree of longevity? I personally think that we've already seen the way in which NFTs have become sort of established, and how there have been an increasing number of stakeholders with skin in the game who are heavily invested in this space. And just briefly, because I said I did want to touch on it, I think it's fascinating how very, very, what we might think of as a very, very traditional institution. So within the trade, the auction houses, and within the public sector, museums and galleries have engaged in this space. So some of them just on a very sort of fairly sort of basic commercial level. So creating NFTs of some of the mainly public domain works in their collection, like the British Museum, the Uffizi. But then there have been much more, creative kinds of projects. If you're interested in this space, do have a look at the Ancient of Days project by the Whitworth Gallery. Stephanie, I think you interviewed Alistair Hudson, director of the Whitworth, and I think he talked a little bit about this. It is a fascinating project whereby the museum created 50 NFTs of a work within their collection, William Blake's Ancient of Days. And then they have been selling those NFTs and tracing what has happened to them. And the data from that project is then going to form part of an exhibition in the Whitworth Gallery, which is looking at kind of changes in economic and social structures and how NFTs and blockchain technology might play into that. I'm going to end on this now, a brilliant project, which I learnt of just the other day at this Metaverse conference I spoke at, and do have a look at this, is a project by, again, you might think a pretty traditional institution, the Department of Buildings in Washington, D.C., no less. And they have created this project all about sort of empowering the local artistic community through giving them the opportunity to make creative works in the physical world on vacant buildings. So buildings which, you know, have been unoccupied perhaps for some time. Artists are given the space, the projects are all vacant to visual, to create works to, you know, really enhance the local neighborhood. And then the next step of the project was to create NFTs so people can buy those NFTs and then the proceeds go back and the local artists are supported through that. So it's kind of a, you know, a circular project, really amazing. And the guy involved is called Ernest Trapper, I think his surname is. But if you have a look at Vacant to Visual, it's on the DOB website, the government website. You can have a look at that project. So I think that's probably where I'm going to finish up now, see if anybody's got any thoughts or any questions.
Oh, that was wonderful. Thank you, Emily. The project, the DC project, I had not heard of that. So thank you for sharing that.
It's cool. It's really cool.
Yes. I would love for you to just mention a little bit about the Damien Hirst currency project.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So this was another cool project with a kind of a bit of a deeper philosophical background. So Damien Hirst created 10,000, I think I'm right saying, of his famous dot paintings. And he then created NFTs of those and put them up for sale. And you bought your NFT and then you had a choice. You could either keep your NFT, in which case the corresponding physical work would be physically burnt, or you could trade in your NFT for the physical work. So this was something like a year, I think, you might have had to make your decision. And anybody want to have a stab at a guess at what the outcome was? How many people wanted the physical work? How many people wanted the NFT? Just a vague percentage. Any guesses? Stephanie, you might know, so.
I'm guessing the sort of people who engage in these sort of schemes are probably more likely to see the digital version as the thing that they want to acquire. I think if you just went to like a regular gallery in the street and said you can have the NFT or you can have the real thing, people would go, what's an NFT? But I think the sort of people signing up to these sorts of deals probably want the NFT.
Yeah, I thought the same, actually. I thought the same. It was actually, it was around 50-50, but very, very slightly in favour of the physical works, which I think is quite interesting because I think, you know, in theory, yeah, we're all up for the whole digital world, but we still do like physical things. And that's what I was mentioning about this. So, you know, this exhibition I went to and the art sect, the DAO in Hackney, we're getting these kind of physical representations. People, I think, still like it. And at the exhibition I went to, it was interesting. This guy, one of the artists there exhibiting, had printed off, I think it was just 50, just fairly basic posters, like A4 posters of a couple of his works. And he said, gosh, this is the first time I've ever done this. And he said, people probably won't want them. And, you know, here's the QR code, go and have a look at my website. Do you know what? There was a queue. Every single one went within a couple of minutes. So interesting. I think there is still this attachment. And Damien Hirst himself, because he bought some of them. And he said when it came to the point where he had to physically burn the works, he found that really hard. It was easier to get rid of the digital version than it was to physically burn that dot painting. So really interesting. Yeah. He's since done another project with his spin paintings, his spin series. And they are, that again is very interesting. So they are, so there's an algorithm. If you buy one of those, it kind of in real time generates a new version of his spin paintings. So yeah, I think they're pretty expensive. I haven't personally partaken myself, but it'd be fun, wouldn't it?
And I wonder, I hadn't heard about that project either. So thank you for mentioning that. I wonder too, like if Damien Hirst was having a problem burning them, if the person that was making that choice had to be the one to burn it, if they might have changed their mind.
Yeah, true. If it's a physical, tangible thing. Yeah, that's kind of hard. Yeah.
One of the points I thought was really compelling in the hearing that you were at was that we really needed an international body. So many countries right now are grappling with what do we do and how do we regulate this? And then there's going to be this inconsistency across different borders.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are some international organizations looking at this, but I think that will need to come to the fore even more, you know, upcoming kind of months and years, because it just doesn't make sense for different countries to be regulating in isolation, because, you know, there are no territorial borders in the metaverse. So I think it does need to be looked at from an international perspective, definitely.
And I mean, there's so much to take in there. That was part of the thing for me. I was going, hang on, oh, that's interesting. And it's like, I'll have to sort of watch the recording. But yeah, I seem to recall, I think there's one Swiss canton that recognizes DAOs and has a legal framework for that to try and encourage people to set them up. And I think, is it Wisconsin or somewhere bizarre that also has some state law that they recognize DAOs? There's one US state that like has done it as well to try and cash in on it.
That's, I can't remember which one it is. I didn't know that. I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, I'll try and find it and send it, because remember when all this started and I did like my little 90-second guide to NFTs I think you were in the conversation. There was some guy who's like the head of some big art finance company, and we're all chatting, and he went, right, I'm just going to have to say this. A week ago, I'd never even heard of the phrase NFT, and I still don't know what they are. And everybody else was going, oh, thank God it's not just me. This was about 2 years ago, but I remember when all that happened and we were just like, Emily, please tell us. It was you and Arena. You were the only people in the world who actually knew what NFTs were.
That's funny.
One other point you touched on that I think is so interesting. You touched on it in your writing and then today a bit, the conflict between a smart contract and the natural term licensing, and whether there's a disconnect between those. Where does that, that's still just up in the air and something to, another point to be grappled with?
Yeah, it very much is, really. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think the smart contract is generally only part of the story. You know, a smart contract will never be able to, I should never say never, should I? But I think it's most unlikely that it will be able to, you know, explain terms about legal liability, you know, exclusion of liability, termination rights, you know, the specifics of a license and exactly what the rights are, what you can and can't do with the work. And so those two things are, I think, are pretty much always going to run in tandem. The likelihood of them being sort of in direct conflict, I suppose, is relatively small, but it's possible. It's possible. And who knows until it happens, you know, how it's all going to come out in the wash. But yeah, it is a good and interesting point, Stephanie. And I think it will be something that we just kind of have to keep a watch on. Just as a very general point, I think all of the stuff is so, you know, it's embryonic. We don't know how these things are going to turn out. And in the parliamentary committee session, that was something else that we were sort of talking about, the fact that, because at the end of the day, the government wants to know, what should we do? Shall we regulate? Where do we go? And I think the advice of myself and the other panelists was that this kind of softly wait and see approach is almost the only way at the moment, because not only is the technology moving so fast, there is law out there that we can apply, and it's just kind of finding the ways, finding exactly you know, how it's going to map onto the specific risks of the NFT world.
I mean, I just think the big problem with like blockchain generally, because it's always been like a solution in search of a problem, is that you're relying on people out there on the internet to validate all this. So, you know, it's something that's completely out of your control. And unless those sort of like, I mean, you see this a lot with the big crypto things where, you know, unless the guys break off from playing their video games to have a quick go on there. I mean, I think the actual transaction time on I think it is Bitcoin where the transaction time had changed from like being a couple of minutes to sort of getting to 14 days for transactions to be verified, just for, you know, for how many people it needed to verify the blockchain. And as people lose interest and the returns are less, it's not like the early days of Bitcoin where you would get a significant amount of Bitcoin. Now you can do all this work and come away with like 0.00004 cents worth if you're lucky. But I'm just wondering what happens there, because effectively, you know, it's great. You know, you're just throwing it out there to the public to do the work.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
just what happens
when they move on to the thing.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, Alan. It's made me think of two things. Firstly, the transaction time. You're right. I was talking to one of the digital artists in this local exhibition I went to a few weeks ago, and I was saying to him, you know, how have you found the transition? You know, how do you find the business? And he said exactly that. You're often waiting around for ages. It's supposed to be this seamless, you know, immediate kind of transacting environment, and often it doesn't work like that. And the other point I was going to make, a completely different one, was that people talk about Web3 and blockchain-based technology. One of the words that's often used is trustless. Trustless because there's not one controlling party that you have to trust. But actually, I very much agree with what you're saying, Alan. In a way, there's a lot, you have to trust loads and loads of people all at once. And, you know, that has its own difficulties and challenges, I think.
Because, of course, as soon as this came on, we all started looking at, like, what are the scams that you could do? How could you exploit this? And, you know, we did find sort of various ways. And especially as it becomes less and less, it's like, actually, you know, it's a bit like the people do it with the online poker, where, you know, it's like, you think you're dealing with an honest broker and you're not. You're dealing with, like, one guy and his seven friends. And you're just sort of wondering what are the opportunities there for doing things. And like you were saying, it was interesting you were saying about taking it off the chain and flipping it across, because like with the artist resale rights, one thing is, you know, an NFT is just an asset, and you could assign that asset or sell that asset just in the good old fashioned paperweight. So, you know, the idea that this is completely transparent, I could just go and say, right, you've got your Beeple NFT. I'll tell you what, I'll buy it off you, but I don't want it on the blockchain. I'll just buy it off you. Just assign it to me and give me your wallet passwords, because that's all I need. And you've got no idea that sales gone through.
Yeah, how would that work? Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, if I don't want to pay the artist resale rights, I will just come to you and just say, I'll give you some cash in exchange for your password and your wallet.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with the resale royalty. I was going to mention this, but I didn't because of time, but it's vulnerable to, so from a strictly legal point of view, the original creator has no privity of contract, no contractual rights against anyone further down the chain. He only has a contract with the first buyer. So you'd be on very, very tenuous legal ground trying to enforce that. You probably couldn't enforce that royalty down the chain. So if it's not working from a technological point of view, it's not automatic because it's gone off chain onto another platform, you'd really be struggling. And again, you're just relying on trust, really.
There will be links in the show notes to learn more. If you are intrigued by this podcast, it would be much appreciated if you could leave a rating or review and tag Warfare of Art and Law Podcast. You can also email your comments to Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com. Until next time, this is Stephanie Draughty bringing you Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What are your plans for the second Saturday of this month? Perhaps consider joining in for a discussion about art, culture, and social issues. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and every second Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I host the Second Saturday Art and Justice Gathering, an online call that explores a range of topics, from artists who might inspire to legal decisions that might infuriate, all with the aim of sparking dialogue about social justice and promoting creative thinking. If interested, please email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com.